evening and welcome to CounterPulse. My name is Jessica Robinson. I'm the executive director here, and I am thrilled to see such a wonderful group of people for Dance Discourse Project number 6. I had to look at my notes because we've done so many of them so far. Let me talk first a little bit about CounterPulse. CounterPulse is a home for artists who are experimenting and taking risks. We have performances here every single weekend of the year, almost every weekend. We have discussions here on weeknights. We have classes. We have rehearsals. I encourage you to sign our mailing list out in the lobby, pick up one of our season brochures, and come back to other events at CounterPulse. This evening's event and the whole Dance Discourse Project series is co-produced with Dancers Group, a fantastic service organization for dance throughout the Bay Area, and my partner in crime, Mary Armentrout, is president of the board of directors of Dancers Group. Dance Discourse Project really came as an idea that Mary and I had about expanding the conversations that happen around dance. We're really good at saying after a show, yes, that was great, but what does that really mean and how can we deepen our exchange around different issues? We've talked about all kinds of things, from what is dance in the Bay Area to multiculturalism in dance to dance and technology, and this evening's performance is really this evening's discussion is really an exciting group of artists who are doing a range of site-specific dance, which is something that we posit is particularly alive and well in our corner of the world. I have a couple of housekeeping notes. One of them is we invite you to use the microphones. I know you're right there and you can hear me without one, but we are recording this for podcast, so the folks who are not here this evening can enjoy it. Please make sure that when you're speaking, you use a microphone. I also ask that if you have a cell phone, you turn it off at this moment. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce Mary Armentrout, my wonderful co-conspirator and the president of the board of directors of Dancers Group. Mary?
Thanks, Jessica. So I just want to first introduce our fabulous panelists here and then introduce our theme, our topic, and then we'll turn it over to these folks here. So tonight we're going to be excavating the notion of site-specific dance in the Bay Area, and the panelists who are going to be speaking in order that they will be speaking are Anna Halprin and Joanna Hygood and Erin Mayling Stewart. And I'm going to give you just a little bit of a flavor of introduction for each of them before I move on to kind of the bigger issue of site-specific. What is that? So, Anna Halprin, without further ado, is basically a Bay Area dance legend, I think it's fair to say. Her diverse career has spanned the field of dance since the late 1930s, and she's been creating revolutionary directions for the art form of dance and inspiring fellow choreographers to take modern dance in new dimensions ever since. She founded the groundbreaking San Francisco Dancers Workshop in 1955 and the Tamalpa Institute in 1978 with her daughter, Daria Halprin. Her students over the years have included Meredith Monk, Trisha Brown, Yvonne Rayner, Simone Forti, Ruth Emerson, Sally Gross, and others, many of whom became involved in the progressive experimental Judson Church group. She also was an early pioneer in the expressive arts healing movement and has led countless collaborative dance programs with terminally ill patients committed to the healing power of dance. For the past decade, she has also led the Circle of the Earth contemporary community dance ritual, which confronts real-life issues facing participant communities around the world. She has, as you might expect, received numerous honors and awards, including a lifetime achievement in modern dance from the American Dance Festival, and the Dance Heritage Coalition named you one of America's irreplaceable dance treasures. Yeah. Interestingly enough, the reason that we decided to do this Dance Discourse Project at this time about site-specific work was because we wanted to be able to fold in something relating to the performance that you're going to be doing May 3rd, which is next Sunday, over in Stern Grove. Yes, we're a week from this Sunday. So hopefully this will totally excite you all about the whole range of site-specific activity, and you'll want to go over and see this wonderful performance May 3rd, either at 11:30 or 2, or perhaps participate or volunteer. So anyways, just keep that in mind. Number two, Joanna Hygood. relocated here from New York in 1980 and co-founded Zacco Dance Theater. Her creative work focuses on making dance that use natural, architectural, and cultural environments as a point of departure for movement, exploration, and narrative. Her works involve in-depth research into the history and the character of sites, and typically integrate aerial flight and suspension as a way of expanding the dancer's spatial and dynamic range. Commissioned by many places, including Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival, many fellowships and awards, including Goldie's and Izzy's, currently teaching at the San Francisco Clown Conservatory. Erin Mayling Stewart, Artistic Director of M Space Dance, has been making dances in the Bay Area since 1999. Her work largely draws inspiration from the ways that people interact and from more hidden aspects of the everyday world. We'll get more into that. Erin's work has been seen throughout the Bay Area, Central California, Florida, and Nevada. During a residency at the Juracity Artists in Residency Program in 2007, she began making videos and has completed 2 dance videos, dance films, and is currently working on a third, and received a Goldie last year. So these are our players, and they will be sharing with you some of their work and thoughts in a moment. But before we do that, I wanted to just kind of set up a thinking structure for site-specific work in dance to maybe give us a through line, a thread to hang our thoughts on or to argue with, whatever makes you happy. So for this dance discourse project, my frame is really 3 questions. What is site-specific dance? Why might it be important? And how is the Bay Area specifically involved in this kind of dance? And my answers to number 1 and number 2 of those questions goes like this. Site-specific dance is one of the strategies that postmodern dance has for creating a more utopian version of life where the boundaries of art and life are less hard and fast or are more integrated. Instead of dance being a single privileged scenario where the audience member passively focuses all their attention on a proscenium stage space where the important action shows up for them, the dancer communicating to them, there are many possible scenarios with differing amounts of activity and passivity in the doers and watchers and a wider range of spatial and temporal configurations in which these occur. Following that? This allows more of reality to potentially be in a dance performance and so allows art to inhabit more of our lives. I think that that's kind of this utopian base motivation for some of this exploration. Some examples that I can think of that are different from what you'll see today are a performance that I heard about where the performers lay on top of audience members and whispered stories into them. Also, a performance where some of it happened, someone was like behind you performing on the floor, and so you couldn't necessarily see them, but you could feel them. So just thinking about how do these things start to chip away at our notion of what a dance performance is in good ways. And then question 3, how is the Bay Area specifically involved in this kind of exploration, has a very interesting historical answer, which is that our own very own Bay Area dance legend, Anna Halprin, basically played a seminal role in creating this postmodern dance movement, and specifically in the exploration of the power of site-specific work. As many of you may know, Judson Church is considered the heart of the postmodern dance movement, but I don't know how many of you know that the Judsonites were mostly people who had been here in California studying and working with Anna before they went over there. So you could really say that Anna is one of the creators of postmodern dance, I think. And as perhaps she will talk about, one of her main tools for exploration over the years, since her husband built it for her, is this outdoor dance deck at her house, nestled in the trees on the side of Mount Tamalpais, open to the sky and the elements. This already brings in so many elements of site-specific dance, a reorganization of dance towards nature, towards people and other beings, towards time and space. For me, just tracing the impact of the presence of this particular site-specific work in the Bay Area because of Anna's activity would be a fascinating study of just kind of building up on how that has influenced us. So those are my 2 themes for the evening. How do these artists that you're going to see grapple with the utopian thrust of site-specific work, and how does the presence of Anna's pioneering work here over the years create a context in which we all as a dance community, as artists, see site-specific work? And so feel free to use that as you think about things or not, but just a little something to get you started. And so now I'm going to turn it over to Anna Halprin.
When are you going to show the visuals, before or after? Oh. Yeah, why don't we look at something instead of talking about it? So let's start that way, if that's okay with the rest of you. All right. Yes. Could you stop for a second? Could you hold it for just a second? Okay, I want to say one thing about this. I just want to say that when you're moving or you're creating dance in the environment, sometimes the only people or the only witnesses you have might be a passing deer or a bird or some other stray dog or somebody that happens to be walking by at the time that you're there. So this was, for me, the first time that I shared my work in the natural environment with human beings. And so you know how we are always limited by the budgets that we have. So we did 5 shoots in one day and then 5 shoots the next day. So there wasn't really time to plan a dance or to rehearse a dance. You just go into the site and respond to it. And so just imagine that you happen to be walking by and all of a sudden you see this figure emerging, and then you continue walking and you imagine that perhaps it was a dream or some other little incident in the environment. So these were done very, very spontaneously. And you're the only ones who are seeing it, actually, in the sense that you weren't there. And this is important to me to say, is that when you dance in something like the natural environment, as you will see here, you're seeing a frame like that. And that isn't what I'm responding to. I'm not responding to the frame that you're seeing. I may be taking my sense of response to a bird that passes by. That becomes part of whatever it is that I'm doing. Or it may have to do with the weather. It may be freezing cold, or it may be hot, or the wind, as in one of the pieces that you're going to see. I have acrophobia, and I happen to be about 80 feet in the air on a cliff, when straight down was the ocean. And the wind happened to be coming from behind me so violently that it was all I could do, you know, to stay solid. So these are things that you don't see when you look at a videotape like this. You don't see the wind or feel the temperature or see the incidental things that are moving around you. And I always have to say that because whenever I, like in this performance that's coming up, one of the important things about it is the way you look at it. And I had somebody give me a response, and she said, "Well, that's empty there." And I empty? My God, there were so many things going on in that environment. I wanted it to be empty of the dancer, the performer. So you could see this wonderful man just strolling by with his dog, or you could see 2 lovers in the corner over there, or you could, you know, all of a sudden see some aeroplane and the noise it made flying overhead. So whenever you look at any kind of dance that's done in the natural environment, it's a different way of looking. So what you're going to see is a piece of a piece. Okay? So now, turn it on. Okay.
the sun was setting. I was just really quite incidental. I want to surrender to the forces of nature to see where it will take me. Life goes on. That a tree grows and it comes to a fruition, it loses its leaves, it dies, and the leaves become part of the ground. There's that cyclic ongoingness of life that I could begin to feel part of. That there was something beyond me that would endure. There was something coming from behind that was pushing me forward into an infinite, infinite space across the ocean, into the horizon. death is simply a transition. It isn't the end. It's the beginning, again, of something new to be born. Before I had cancer, I used life to inform my art. After I had cancer, I used art to inform my life.
Okay.
Oh, honey, I was able to move.
Well, honey,
I'm sick.
No, I mean...
Literally, you won't.
No, I literally won't.
Okay. Right. Wait a minute. Let me just straighten up the last little bit. Look at me.
Can you follow me?
Uh-oh. Can I put them in your... Oh,
God. You're awful, but what is the good of all this if you're not going to be able to do it?
Look and see if you can find the song.
What? Okay.
Anna.
Oh, is that the only place? There isn't any place in front of those trees? I'm going to go get more. Some of my earliest and happiest memories are really as a child, just running wild. Thank you.
So I just hope that all of you could have imagined in the part where she's under the white thing that you were seeing a full image, because you weren't so much, but it's really beautiful footage, and that if you can just imagine the way in which in the real footage you're just disappearing into the elements. So you guys had a more kind of abstracted version of that, unfortunately.
That you really couldn't see the environment. So someday, if you'd like to see it, just write to me and I'll send you a video.
Yeah, it's beautiful in the way that the bird and you kind of cohabit the space. Yeah. 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 Would you like to say a few more words, or we can wait until we get to question time?
If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
I want to hear about the character in this last.
I'd like you to speak a little bit more about that beautiful, the last dance.
Oh, that was the only one you could see. That's why you wanted to.
It was just, it was fascinating. Well, the character
what,
was
what
so
I attempted
wonderful.
To do all through that video, that this was, it's an hour long video, so this was just the last 10 minutes. I attempted to use the elements in nature as part of my body covering. Mm. And this is very, this is not an original idea. This is what all indigenous people do. They take the materials from their environment, become part of their costumes or their body covering. So it's a total identification. So in that particular piece, I was working with a meadow, and I was working with the feeling of the meadow. So I just put it on me and saw what would happen. And, all these things were very experimental. I didn't know what was going to happen until it started getting put on me. But the one in the water was what my attitude was, that I was just going to be in the water and move only when the waves moved me. And so that became the point of departure. And the one that I was up on the cliff, I was just really covered with white gauzy stuff so that I felt more part of the clouds passing by. Yeah. And so all the way through, the one of them where I wanted to be part of a decaying tree, I just covered myself with molasses and then took the rot from the tree and just covered my body with it. So I was, totally tree. So in each of the different pieces, and I think there must be maybe 15 or 20 episodes, in each episode I tried to use the environment as part of my body covering. So, and each one was a surprise. I was just hoping the bees wouldn't come around when I was in the rotting tree. But the theme that I used throughout was the theme of the recycling of life and death. Yeah. So any other questions about that? Okay. One of the nicest things about working in the environment is working with the different times of the day, working with dusk. That was working with dusk and the idea of going into the dust and going into my death. So whereas the first one, with the water, was working with the idea of the birth. So that's one of the special things. And there's another one in there, working at night. So that's what's so special about working in the environment, is that you can work with different times of the day and night as well.
Yeah. Can you speak a little bit to how that changes your sense of time? Duration? I mean, do you feel like, kind of longer spaces of time are, you can go for longer, dance of expands longer?
Of course.
Different.
And again, I think that I was given a lot of permission to work with expanding time by spending a lot of time watching some of the indigenous dances that the American Indians do, where they might do a corn dance that lasts for 5 days. And so the expansion of time gives you an opportunity to shift your consciousness in a way that taps into the way you move. Like the one in the ocean, I was just there for hours just waiting for something, for a wave to come and wash me up. And it was freezing cold. So another thing that you have to do when you're working in the natural environment, you really need to alter your consciousness in a way that you're not making any judgments about, ooh, this is cold, you know. But it's cold, so your body just says it's cold, or, you know, you just accept it without any judgments. And that does alter your consciousness in a way that enables you to move a little differently. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because it seems to me that watching the wave one, you know, if I watch with kind of my normal dance eyes, I'm kind of like, oh, it's kind of slow and not necessarily so much is happening. And then if you kind of, you let that expectation go away because you're so present in what you're doing, then I can get into that way of seeing.
Yeah, but if you could have seen it, you couldn't see anything on that, thing up there. but you see, that's a different way of looking. There was so much going on. Mm-hmm. The patterns of the waves mm-hmm. that were spiraling or swinging, swishing, the rhythms that were doing. I was just one little piece of driftwood in there. So when you look at something like that, that isn't what you look at. You look at the total picture. You develop periphery vision so that as you're looking, so if I'm looking at my friend sitting there, I'm looking at Julie, I know that she's wearing a certain sort of rust color, but I can see everything. I can see every one of you around here. Every one of you are part of the way I'm looking at Julie. So nothing is long. It's like, you know, sitting and just watching the water and saying, oh, that's so long, nothing's happening. Well, there's hundreds of things that are happening, and they're all part of my notion about life is that it dances. Mm-hmm. It isn't just me. I'm not an object in nature. I mean, how boring that is. You know, who cares? I'm just part of it. And if I take this movement here, it's just part of whatever else is going on. So I'm always dancing with many, many things I'm aware of. And so it's challenging to put that in a square screen. And it's even more challenging to try to look at it there. But that requires a different attitude about what dance is. That's the crux of it. It's a different attitude about what you expectations of dance is. And I find that dancing in nature enables me and those that join me in that experience, it enables me to live my life more deeply. And it affects my philosophy about life. It affects my relationships to other people and to other animals and to other aspects of nature. And I feel that if people were more like indigenous people that live off of nature, that we wouldn't have this problem we have with our extinction right now. That we don't look at nature as part of our collective being. I mean, who we are, what we breathe, is all part of something so much bigger than any one of us. And that if we, as children, we learn to have that sensibility, I don't think the world would be threatened. The planet would be threatened today.
Yeah, I think you've gotten right down into the heart of it.
So that's
terrific. Yeah. Awesome. So shall we move right along? I think, Joanna, this is a really lovely lead-in for you.
It's so interesting to juxtapose the work because our concerns are very similar and the what manifests from those things are, it's just very interesting, very different. But now I'm going to completely change my work. I'm going to, you know, I keep saying I'm going to come over and be with you for the rest of my life. Yeah, I know we're neighbors. But that was so beautiful and so inspiring. So I think we're good, right, Patrick? Are you ready? Of course, because I am so complicated here, it's a little complicated technically to pull off the video. But I'm just going to follow Anna's lead, and I'll talk a little bit afterwards. I'll just say that this is wrong. No, that we're going to move ahead into more recent work. Let's see, there, you're going to go fast. Well, I'll see, you get a little view of the old stuff kind of quickly. Whoop, there we go. Sometimes this stuff looks better when it's this fit. Here we go. You can stop now. Okay. There we are. Okay. This is at the San Francisco airport.
In a giant hangar or something like
that? No. This is in the terminal, the international terminal. This was a piece commissioned by the San Francisco International Arts Festival, and the theme of that year was the African diaspora. See those? This is a piece that was commissioned by a dancers group last August. It's called A Shifting Cornerstone, and it was kind of traced the history of that particular, the site right outside and around the Yerba Buena Center. You probably recognize most of it. This, like the other piece, was an installation piece. This went on for 5 hours every day. This was a 30-minute loop that continued over, I think it was 10 days. I think, I can't remember now. piece was kind of embedded in the site, so often it was a little confusing who was actually in the piece. There were a lot of impromptu participants. This last piece I'm going to, that's on this reel, is Invisible Wings, and it was a piece commissioned by Jacob's Pillow Dance Festival in the Berkshires, and the site where the festival is was a station on the Underground Railroad during the mid-19th century, so this traces and expresses this history. The audience does a lot of walking in this piece. This is Linda Tillery and the Cultural Heritage Choir, and they were collaborators on this project. So all the music for the piece was live. Technical difficulties. There was a really great horse in the piece. as you can see.
How great.
The biggest horse I've ever seen in my life. Well, maybe we can, yeah. We could either try to fast forward a little and see if that helps, but it's almost done. See if it, yeah. There we go. Let's see if you fast forward, if it cleans up there. This is a section that has the endless, the bottomless wagon. If you go to the last, can you get to the last scene? Just a little bit past here. There's just some really great dancing. The one section that has some really great dancing. See if it'll work. A little past this, keep going. Keep going. This is a piece that section is about the Juba dance. Here, you can stop here. Oh well. Okay, what did you say, Anna? If you really want to see this section, you can write me and I can send you a copy. Yeah, there's some wonderful dancing in this section, but oh well. Yeah, bummer. Yeah, we can stop.
Yeah. This will just give us more time to
time
hear
to talk.
Joanna talk.
I'm less interesting than the video, actually.
No.
So, thank you. My turn to be frustrated. Well, what shall I talk about? Well, a lot of the work that I do, it's varied. I mean, I'm very interested in histories and interested in the how we define place and how our social behaviors and our structures and our histories impact place and determine how we ultimately define it. And I'm also very interested in time and looking at memory, and some of these installations have been very interesting because they're continuous and you can see them from a lot of different perspectives over extended periods of time, which then begin to engage your memory and really changes the way that you experience the work. And I'm very interested in those qualities and the quality of time, all the different aspects and the way that we experience it. And the pieces that you saw here were, that one in particular is a very direct connection to the site itself and also with a very specific and very important history. And I spent many years, this is that piece I originally did in 1998 and just redid again a couple of years ago, but I spent probably a good part of 3 or 4 years preparing and researching that. And that seems to be an important part also of the work in general. I think I'm much better at answering questions than I am just rambling.
One thing I think I just went back and looked at the little write-up for the cornerstone piece.
Yeah,
shifting,
yeah.
And the Joseph Beuys idea that you talk about in there of
social structure,
social sculpture. Yeah. I think that that's that piece in particular is a really good example of that. And that, for example, the Underground Railroad piece or the airport piece aren't quite as embedded in everyday life as much. And so I don't know if you can speak about the differences or...
Well, this one was so interesting because I think that it... I think, Anna, you touched on it a little bit about when you were speaking about the way that we experience space and experience a place, how we're very determined to find things that are happening and we've kind of predetermined what they should be, and instead of actually being still and examining and experiencing and letting the place or the situation unfold and light up for you, to be able to really sit quietly and expand into a place, I think, is something that we've lost. And so in this case, it was wonderful because people couldn't quite tell where it was. So what they were doing was they were expanding the way that they were looking at the site or at the place, and then engaging scenarios and situations that really weren't part of that. Well, they were part of the piece, and that was the point, but that weren't necessarily things that had been shaped. And so it was really great because people would come back and say, "And I love the part where the woman comes by with the cart, and then she stops and gets a cigarette." I was like, "Well, really, when did that happen? I missed that altogether." And I think that that's a very important thing to remember and to encourage.
Yeah, and I just think that, you know, doing it in an urban situation as you were doing in this piece versus the work that Anna showed of doing it in nature, you know, you just get a different product in a certain way, even though the process is similar.
Well, there's a lot also in an urban environment. There's a lot of nature in urban environments, which people also forget about or don't notice. There was a piece that I didn't show that was called Chomu Butterfly Dreams, which was about the swallowtail butterflies that live in the city. And I worked with a wonderful visual artist, Reiko Goto, who works a lot with natural processes and creatures. And but anyway, they're living in our fennel bushes, which of course are, you know, considered a weed and are constantly being hacked down and taken away. But there was, you know, a thriving creature that's so beautiful and so poetic in many ways amongst us, along with all the various birds. I mean, there are hawks flying around in the city. There's all sorts of things that are completely overlooked because we've narrowed the focus in the way that we move through our lives. So,
cool.
Yeah.
All right. So, moving right along, Erin.
Thanks. I think I'm just going to show video and then sort of tell you after what you were looking at.
rushes of feet, sunlight streams in the window. Colored by dawn, waiting in the iron. This never turns out how it's supposed to. And I don't know why. And
all right, should we?
Yeah, it's like 30 more seconds. Yeah.
Exactly what happened to me last night. Yeah, it's fun. Very nerve-wracking. So what that stuff was the first thing was a little music video that I made at Jurassi, which has an artist residency program in Woodside, which is when I first started working with video. And then the other three are all from a film that I'm making based on a site-specific work I did in my house in the fall called Keyhole Dances. And just to give you an idea of what it was like as a performance, at the kitchen table, it was actually in a different room from where we filmed it, and we had the audience was broken into groups of 6 to 8 people, and they all sat at the table with the performers, which made some people feel profoundly awkward, apparently. And there was somebody playing guitar in the pantry. And in the bathroom, everybody was like really crowded into this tiny space, and the musician was in the kitchen. And then the bedroom was a little bit more of a standard theatrical setup where people sort of stood or sat, and the bed was sort of the stage, and then the musician was singing in bed with recorded music. So that's what we were looking at.
I have a question. Yes. So one of the possibilities of site-specific dance is sort of collapsing that life-art dichotomy, and I see, because this is your own home, I see that happening with you perhaps the most. And I'm wondering if you want to talk a little bit about your motivations for making work in your home and how that was different than making it for a proscenium stage.
Sure. My interest in site-specific work did start at Jurassic, which is why I showed that, and it's not quite as intimate as being in my home, but I was really, really burned out on making work for the stage, and in fact had folded my company, and of course that's when I got a residency. So when I did come back from that, I didn't make any actual finished pieces while I was there. But when I came back, I moved into this new place, and the vibe that I had at Jurassic of like this incredibly low barrier to from any seed of an idea to action and doing something sort of carried over, so that when I'm looking at my bathtub and thinking of these friends of mine and their relationship, it seemed like it was going to be very easy to do. And I think that was part of what my interest was the idea that it was going to be easy, which it sort of was. And the collapsing of the life and the art definitely, it sort of felt organic to make a piece at my house, so I would choreograph in my bed. It was like my friends just came over and we would have some tea and rehearse. It was great. I think one of the most interesting things for me about the overlap there was working in the bedroom, because Tom, who's the performer, is my boyfriend, and so I'm there in bed, like, going and, like, lying on him, and then having the dancer, like, get in bed with him and be like, okay, now lie on him, and anyway, that's... they definitely overlapped there.
Just as I was watching, you know, just to think about the context of, you know, doing this sort of movement where you're, okay, if you're in bed and you do this movement of closing your eyes, in just to see the beauty of that movement and the power that it has in that context. But if you came out here, you lied on the floor, you did that movement, it would have a completely different meaning and a completely different way of resonating. And just so that, again, it's so obviously opening up this place of adding more of the possibilities of movements to be considered dance, if you want, or to figure out the way to make them show up as that. Because every night when you go to sleep, don't you think about, you know, how is this dance, or how do I experience this as a communicative action or event? And so here was a way of making that happen.
Several people asked me about doing the piece on bringing it to stage, and I just thought it would not be good. And that I was interested in like the experience for the audience being totally different, like coming over to somebody's house. And I really wanted it to feel that way, so that it wasn't what you were saying in the beginning of that thing where the audience comes in and they sit over there and nothing is expected of them. And the idea that like it's sort of for some specific kind of person or something like that. And I think I liked the familiarity of all of this. It's like everybody has breakfast and sleeps and fights in the bathroom, I guess. And I think one of the nice things about this was the pieces were actually kind of really easy to make, because you just put yourself in that situation and then do what you would do. So they are dances, but they also kind of made themselves, because I didn't have to come up with some new movement vocabulary. Like, all of that movement exists in our daily lives. And I don't know if I go through my life thinking like I'm going to bed and this is like a dance, but I think I do like the idea that for a minute after seeing that piece that people might have thought about that.
I think that comment on vocabulary can really open up this conversation, because one of the things that I was curious about for all of the panelists is, how does the site, you know, the ideas certainly influence the ideas of the piece, but how does moving in a different site influence the actual physical movement and the choreography? And I've heard you speak about the meridians extending beyond the body and how they can extend in a different way when you're in space. And Joanna, I know you dance on the sides of buildings, which is a whole different movement vocabulary. So I'm wondering if you two can speak a little bit about the possibilities that are opened up by this way of working.
Well, I want to just stop where I am right now, thinking about what I've just seen. And I think it really boils down to the difference between dancing in a theater, a conventional theater situation, is you're dealing with illusion. Mm. It's totally illusionistic art. And you can do certain things in a theater working with that concept of illusion. When you're working in an environment, you're dealing with life. It takes you into a living situation where you're dealing with either history, or you're dealing with intimacy, or you're dealing with props, or you're dealing with people, or you're dealing with ethnicity. I mean, it's so connected to your real life that the intention is so completely different. And why you do it in the first place is a question that I always ask myself every time, why am I even doing this? Mm-hmm. There's something about your piece when I was at Jacob's Pillow, mm-hmm. and I saw it on the video. Mm-hmm. It really brought me back to what it was really like for the slaves to go through that experience. And it's more the way indigenous people work with dance. When my son-in-law is a Cheyenne Indian, and he once said to me, I didn't know that that dance was supposed to be beautiful. I just thought it was part of life. And it's an entirely different concept. So all these questions about your movement vocabulary or this or that or the other thing is interesting, but I don't think it's the point. I think the point is, what is your belief system around why you're dancing? And what do you want to do with that, that dedication you have? Because of all the arts, I think it's probably the most difficult. So you have to give yourself over completely to a commitment. And I think that all these things that I've seen, you would live your life differently in your apartment. You'd be more aware when you take a bath or you're having breakfast with your boyfriend or whatever. You know, and that's what really interests me. That's all I have to say right at the moment, just in response to what I've seen.
I think we're going to open up in just a moment. We will absolutely get to you.
I'm not sure what to add because I thought that was really well stated. But maybe I'll just say that there are moments when your body is in relationship to material. So let's say that is water, that's earth, it's grass, it's concrete, and a wide variety of things. And that's something that is kind of inherent to making site work, because the materials are constantly changing. So how you're interacting and the things that you're, how your body responds to the materials is always changing. And and that's something that's very exciting to me, because you're always learning something new about yourself through your body as you relate to these new materials. When I'm dancing in water is not at all the same as when I'm dancing high on a steel girder. It's very, very different. And so I think that it taps into all these different parts of, you know, what we call ourselves, our bodies, and their potential.
And then just through the flat surface or
yeah.
Please use the microphone.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Thank you. We're recording this. So.
Just the difference between walking on a flat surface or walking on a hill or walking, trying to deal with a cliff. Your body needs to adapt in unexpected ways. Mm-hmm. So it's a fresh movement experience. It's not a technique. Mm-hmm. And I think that breaks down another barrier that's very important, is that traditionally in dance, we have various techniques. You know, this technique or that technique or that technique. But when you're dancing in an environment, you have the possibility of breaking away from that restriction and that habit. Mm-hmm. And that can be exciting.
Yeah, the technique is really to be flexible and expanding into the, and be responsive. Yeah.
I think that's what I was getting at with my question. Yeah. So let's open it up to the audience. I know lots of people have things to say. So,
hello. I dance... So in the piece with Iron. And actually, I just wanted to say that so the video, for me, doesn't reflect enough what happened because we did it a lot of time during the day. So we start to have a context, and we dance in a context, and we really start to feel at home. So the audience came, and they were almost disturbing by the fact that we were at home. And so in between performances, we had some break, and we really hung around like we were at home. So the process itself, I feel, give this idea of, you know, site-specific. As a performer, I felt at home in my bed, not with my boyfriend, but in my bed.
Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to come and listen to the talk about site-specific because last year, the most enjoyable dancing I saw was the San Francisco trolley dances. And I realized they are highly choreographed, but they were so enjoyable. And so after tonight, I'm wondering, is that a different type of site-specific dancing? Am I going to see different categories of site-specific dancing, like some of what I saw tonight? So I'm just, because I really fell in love with that dancing last year, but now I realize there's a lot more to site-specific dancing, and I guess I have a lot more to learn, so.
Well, I mean, partly I would just say there's probably a continuum, or there's, you know, there's stuff for stage, and all the way to, I feel like in a way what you're seeing here is fairly extreme examples, if you want to put it that way, that are far away from proscenium dancing. And there's plenty of stuff in between that's a little more like you just take closer to stage dancing and put it in a different environment and keep the audience relationship the same, for example, so that it doesn't, not everything is exploded all at once necessarily. Anyone else want to add to that?
It's a wonderful festival that you're referring to, and the beauty of it is that Kim, who produces it, tries to find areas that people normally don't go to, and so you follow this path into, you know, the great unknown of San Francisco neighborhoods and you know, all of these new places are revealed to you, and they're not, you know, these super spectacular, you know, now we're going to go to the Golden Gate Bridge. It's their neighborhoods and little corners of the city, which are not necessarily well explored. Although, you know, there was Market Street. She did Market Street, but often you went off of Market Street into these smaller areas that you might not normally explore. So it's really a wonderful festival.
I also kind of think that for site-specific dance, even if it's not so far removed from the way, like if it's not choreographed so differently from how it would be in the theater, it's still a really completely different experience when you take it to a site, especially if you encounter it by surprise, you're walking down the street, you see it. Like even if somebody brought a stage piece outside, it sort of becomes site-specific. It starts to respond to the site naturally, and I think... So there is that continuum that Mary was talking about. And I also just think there's different artists, so everybody's site-specific work is going to be totally different, I hope.
excuse me. About that, about taking a stage piece out into the environment and that automatically responding differently, I'm wondering how that's different than moving a piece that was built for a stage that's 6 meters by 7 meters to a stage that is 2 meters by 3 meters, because the performers are still responding to wings being in different places, the props or the decorations being different. How moving theaters, moving props, and responding to your environment while you're performing, whether it's on stage or not, how is that not site-specific?
I guess my feeling about that is that for the audience, it's a very different experience, like all the things that you see. And also, as a, you know, I've performed in Venue 9 and on Yerba Buena stage and whatever, and like it is different. But I think that as performers, we know that space. It is each theater does have its own characteristics, but in a way, you know that it is that like blank space, and you do, like, you know, some theaters have a lumpy floor or whatever, but like your relationship to the audience remains very similar. And so, like, I feel like I can come on to any empty stage and have that sort of like chorus line, whatever it is, feeling of the floodlights and whatever, and I am performing to you, and I could have that on a stage of any size. Whereas once you take yourself out of that like space that's very comfortable for us, you have to open up something different in order to respond.
Yeah. I mean, isn't that what Anna is talking about in the sense of that the stage space is an illusion? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Joanna.
It's more than that.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned when we were at the house that I was giving you a demonstration of something. I noticed that when we're indoors in the studio and the participants reach up and they think, this is up. But when they go outside and up becomes a very different experience, and you see their bodies go like that. So everything changes internally.
I was just thinking about, because I'm just about to make a piece for a theater or theaters, which I don't do very often, and you know, I used to think, oh, it's just not that interesting. But a few years ago, I thought about the theater, and I wondered, why wasn't I thinking of it more as a site? Why was I so consumed by the fact that it was a stage over there, and then the people sat over there? And it actually is a site. Yeah. So, and it comes with its own. Yeah. a package of meaning, and people come and they have expectations, they've defined what it is, and there's air moving through it, there's colors, there's so much as a site, and it has really a long history, no matter where it is in terms of, you know, what theater is, that manipulating and working with those ideas became fascinating, and so the work was suddenly unfolding in a new way. And I'm not thinking so in such a confined way. Of course, so now I'm making it more complicated, and now the theaters don't want me to come in because it's going to be too complicated. Yeah. But now it's a different relationship, and it can do things that are very different from, you know, an outdoor environment that I think can be equally as engaging if you are conscious of that. Often we, you know, you go to a stage and you think about it as, say, there I am on this, you know, this platform over there, and it has lights and so on, but you forget about the fact that people walked off of a street and they came through a lobby and what that lobby experience was like, and then they moved through and then they moved through the stage. And if you become conscious of that and you start to shape, you know, add that into what you are shaping, that the experience becomes much broader and richer in terms of what material you're then creating with it. So,
yeah, I mean, I think that in actuality there's another continuum going on here of attention to sight that can be brought to any site, so that we can turn the theater space into a site. And if you look at people like Jerome Bell, I think that that's exactly one thing that he's doing, and that's a further layer in this conversation.
Such a violent response.
Other comments back there behind you? Yeah.
I'm wondering, and I think, Joanna, you're starting to kind of talk about this from maybe the performer's perspective, but from the audience perspective with site-specific, are there any ways in which, Aaron's piece very much worked actively to make the audience not act like a passive audience, but in site-specific, I'm wondering if there's any ways in which you guys have actively worked to break down the audience's tendency to behave like the passive audience in a stage, proscenium stage type of setting.
Yeah, I mean, either like the cornerstone or Anna thinking about what I've been hearing about these mask people, or I don't know, the other things in the Stern Grove piece and ways that you're working with that idea.
I think we're really talking about the audience experience, and you know, in Aaron's piece, they were scrunched into a room, and in Joanna's piece, they had to walk. And I know that many of your pieces, like the circle dance, is really about the audience participation. And so we were just thinking about what is the audience experience that's different, and how do you provoke or engage that?
It depends upon
with the microphone.
I think it depends upon your intention and what you happen to be choosing to do in the site. And I think you're referring to the planetary dance. And that has both a history and it has a site, and it has a message. And I think that in this particular dance, the planetary dance, there is no audience. Mm-hmm. It is a participatory event. Mm-hmm. And it's designed so that it's so simple that anybody could do it. It's just a series of circles, but the task is very challenging, and it's based on running. And however, it accommodates people of all ages, including children, who have their own run. But what makes it, I think it's probably, I call it the planetary dance because it's being done in about 36 different countries now, because it is so simple. But what really interests me about that piece, which was very accidental, was that people are running for a reason. And the reason that they're running is so important to them, and they believe so thoroughly in the power of dance that it becomes a very powerful experience, not to look at, but to do. Mm-hmm. They run for some particular thing. In our community, we had I don't know if any of you remember the trailside killer on Mount Tamalpais killed 7 women, and we could no longer really use the mountain. So we decided we would try to reclaim the mountain, and we bussed up there. We did workshops for a year to prepare people, and we bussed up there, and we did this circle dance. And it was to reclaim the mountain. And about 2 weeks later, after 2 years, the killer was caught. So it became a tradition. And every year we took a different cause, whether it was breast cancer, whether it was violence in the schools, or whatever the cause might be. And the community, including the children and the parents and people of all different ages, would get together every year and do this ritual. So that has been always one of the most fulfilling ways that I've experienced using a site, because it's had so much meaning to so many people, and it's been so simple. And yet it had, for each person, they believe in it so much. So I think it depends. I'm having a struggle with that in the Stern Grove project, how to break the audience-performer relationship. Mm-hmm. But it's a real consideration. Mm-hmm. And I think it's different in each intention that you have.
I have a question about vocabulary in planetary dance, the motivations for running caused the group to begin running, and that became the dance. In Aaron's, there seemed to be a lot of technical dance vocabulary and clear correlation between music and movement. And I'm just wondering how your vocabulary emerged from your ideas, or what your process was like.
I did choreograph to music, which I like to do. And I think that, I guess I didn't really stress out about the vocabulary too much on this dance. And I think when I've made pieces for stage in the past, one of my frustrations was the difficulty in like getting past my movement habits to try and find some movement that's more interesting. But in this setting, I was just less concerned about whether the dance movements were interesting. And so I think maybe that the dance vocabulary that you see in those is just sort of my dance vocabulary. But to me, I was able to stay interested in it because there were characters and sort of objects to deal with. And just like, I just had, for each section, I just had a situation, a really vague situation in mind, you know, like they had a fight the night before, whatever, and now they're not speaking to each other. And I sort of let that drive things forward. So the vocabulary that was dictated by each place was really like sort of practical, like you're mostly lying down in bed and the mattress is this like memory foam thing, which really isn't springy at all. So I don't know, like, there are things like that, and the fact that we're like dealing with this tabletop and all of these items and stuff. But there is the dance movement that is in there wasn't like lovingly, carefully like crafted just for that environment.
So one of my questions is about the economy and how site-specific dance relates to money. And it's not something that's come up yet. And just it occurs to me that proscenium theater and dance always has a ticket price, and site-specific usually doesn't. And in this current time, it just seems like, wow, what are the possibilities for more site-specific dance? And also, I don't know much about site-specific dance's history in relationship to the economy, or how dancers before thought about, hey, let's make dance that's free, or, you know, if how that has played into it before. And I'm just curious what any of the panelists think about that.
I would love to segue. Anna, when we talked earlier, you were talking about when you first came here after World War II, and there were just not opportunities to perform because you had to pay so much money to be in a theater with hired musicians. And a lot of your work was really a response. I think it's very much in line with what you're talking about.
Yeah, when I first came here, in order to dance in the theater, you had to hire a full orchestra. That was a union regulation. So you didn't dance in theaters.
Yeah, actually was better. It's better now than then. Amazing, but yeah.
Yeah. There's no answer for that in this country. You know, when I went to Paris, the dancers were on strike, and I thought, what are they on strike about? You know, I couldn't figure it out. They were on strike because they weren't being paid enough. They get paid every year. If you do 5 performances, you're considered a professional, and the government pays you, whether you're performing or in between. So it's just a value system, cultural value system in our country. You know, you have to learn to be a very slick proposal writer and get some good reviews, and it's terrible. It's really terrible. I have no answer for it. Never have.
I did partially do this project because it seemed doable, and I've self-produced in theaters and all that stuff, and I just didn't want to deal with that anymore, nor do I really want to deal with it now. So I'm trying to figure out how to keep making dances. I don't like have a point where I've got like an organization and all of that stuff. So it really was that was like I wanted to be very like DIY and cheap. And oddly enough, we got a cash grant to do that project, but and so we paid the dancers with that. But it was sort of like a creative, like, well, I'd like to do something, and I don't want to go out and fundraise and write the proposals. And,
in the front, then.
I was just thinking about the place of the video camera as a critter in the environment, in the site-specific environment. And I wonder if any of us can do anything without imagining it on YouTube simultaneously. And are we all post-Indigenous people now because we can't imagine? I mean, an Indigenous person couldn't imagine it being recorded and shown back at a later time. And are we? Can we never go back to that state?
I think there's something that's occurring to me. Excuse me for being so gabby, but you know, going back to Indigenous people, going back to the origins of dance, people weren't paid to dance. It was an honor to dance. It was so much part of their lives that it gave them a spiritual boost, and they wanted to dance. Our culture has gotten so commercialized that we've forgotten the spiritual value behind dance. Dance was always a way to really touch your spiritual being. And it was an honor to be a lead dancer. The idea of being paid was the last thing in the world. The idea was, this is my way of praying. This is my way of teaching my children. This is the way that I develop the value of my community. This was something you did out of love. And now we've become totally commercialized. So we have to worry about proposals and getting grants and how much you're going to pay the dancers and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, right now at the age of 89, I've been dancing all my life. And I've just gotten to the point where, yeah, I want to go back to being primitive. I want to go back to being just early mankind. And if I'm going to continue living my life with dirty feet, and I'm going to dance because I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wanted to add one other thing because I do think there is that side where we're, you know, professional dancers and our struggles and so on, but I think people are still dancing everywhere. I mean, you know, there's so much dancing in the street right now. And I think that maybe people are not able to articulate the source right now, but I do think that people are, they're getting that spiritual boost. Mm-hmm. You know, that they are being moved, that they are being pushed to feel things in a different way. I mean, I feel like more than ever. I mean, there's always trendy dancing, but I mean, people dancing in clubs, salsa, everything. I mean, that's real dancing too. That's their stuff. And the places that people go to, the endorphins that they generate, the expansion of whatever it is their experience in those moments and their connection to their bodies is real in those moments, and they don't necessarily need to be classified in this, you know, what if it's professional, it's better, or whatever. I mean, I think that we as our animal selves are still reaching for that, yet we don't necessarily still connect it to the, you know, to those deeper, we can't articulate what those deeper things are, but they're there. And it would be great if we could erase the thing in between and the grant and the, you know, that it was all. And even this moment where I'm here is my dance.
The one other thing I'm thinking about that is that as performers, I don't know if the, like, specter of the camera is that different from the audience being there. So the performing experience to me has always been like kind of living in this place in between, like trying to have my experience and be true to the experience, but at the same time having the awareness of people being there watching. And I think the camera is very similar to somebody being there watching. But I do think, in general, we are post-Indigenous, and that people do, you know, have this like outside awareness of themselves a lot in the audience, in a dance, everywhere. But also, as somebody who's making video now, I wouldn't entirely want to. I wouldn't want to get rid of that, and I do think that things, just because they are on film, I like to think that things that are on film have the capacity to touch people and move people also.
Crumping is a great example of that. I was just trying to tap into that. I mean, and that is primitive. I mean, that dance is really primitive, mm-hmm. and it comes out of the street, and it comes out of a very intense experience, life experience, and it's being pushed and expressed in this quite extraordinary way. So I think it's still there.
Or, I mean, I think that one way that we can be post-Indigenous is that we can go to Yerba Buena and do the circle dance on election night with Anna, and so have both in a weird way of being both knowing that YouTube is there, but knowing that we can sometimes at least access this Indigenous aspect that's still inside of us and living.
Well, one of the things that we like to do here with the Dance Discourse Project is to wrap it up while we still have something to say, because we have wine and we have snacks, and we hope that you will stick around and talk with each other, continue this conversation, and also speak with the panelists. And I also just want to give a shout out, because as we talk about everyone participating in dance, now is a great time to do that because of National Dance Week. So if you didn't already, pick up one of the cute little green booklets that Keegan is waving back there, because there are just hundreds of opportunities to participate and witness dance for free in the next 10 days. So I encourage you to enjoy that.
Can I just say one other thing? In terms of National Dance Week, it's not announced publicly, but we are having an open rehearsal on a Friday, the May 1st, and I'm inviting all of you to come to the invitational open rehearsal Friday from 2 to 3:30.
Thank you.
Great. So yeah, stick around. There'll be wine appearing magically over in that corner, and we'd love to hear more intimately from you. So yeah, don't stop now.